Isn't it sad when neighbors don't get along? As I look out the window, I can see our quiet little block of Seattle, notwithstanding Bob and Ruth's little dogs next door, who seem to be able to sense me at 50 paces and start yapping away. I've learned not to take it personally. Things aren't always that placid. There can be serious neighborhood disagreements and gripes, which can escalate into arguments, cold fury, lawsuits, and even worse. Rarely, however, does that lead to invasion. Tough to imagine with the people on the next block, but history has repeatedly shown it's not unheard of between nations. So it's not a terrible idea to have a plan, just in case, no matter how unlikely or ridiculous it might seem, and no matter who might be to blame. A document that might have changed the world. Defense Scheme Number 1, a plan for a preemptive Canadian invasion of the United States, drawn up by Colonel James Sutherland Buster Brown, 1921. I'm Joe Janes of the University of Washington Information School, and no, I'm not making this up, and no, it's not funny, except it kinda is, though maybe, you never know. The borders between the U.S. and Canada, all 5,525 miles, or 8,891 kilometers, are often hailed as the world's longest military undefended, a source of pride and reassurance on both sides for generations. It wasn't always quite so amicable. Recall that much of eastern North America and all of current Canada was claimed by England, and then Britain, developing from the 17th century onward in various colonial chunks. Then there was that revolutionary business in the 1770s, which included a disastrous attempt at a winter invasion of Quebec, led by Benedict Arnold, in 1775. During the War of 1812, British forces occupied Maine in 1814 and renamed it New Ireland, the culmination of many back-and-forth struggles over a couple of centuries in the territory, which finally got fed up and achieved statehood in 1820. Small skirmishes followed, a dispute over the border of Maine, known colorfully as the Aroostook War in 1839, amounting to very little, and an 1866 attempted invasion by a bunch of Irish Americans crossing the Niagara River into Ontario, skittering back when actual soldiers showed up. All pretty small potatoes and easily dismissed as nutty, not unlike the War on Canada plot of South Park Bigger, Longer, and Uncut in 1999, which spawned the earworm song Blame Canada and includes the line, "They're not even a real country anyway." 3 years later, however, in a spectacularly unhinged article entitled Bomb Canada, The Case for War, in the Conservative National Review, Jonah Goldberg proposed precisely that, because apparently Canadians like peace and universal health care and being decent people and standing up for their national identity. Perhaps destroying the CN Tower or an empty hockey stadium. He closes with these immortal words, "In a sense, the U.S. owes it to Canada to slap it out of its shame spiral. That's what big brothers do." So it's not entirely without cause that Canadians might be, shall we say, a touch wary about their southern and western neighbor across the way. Following World War I, lots of geopolitical puzzle pieces had been tossed into the air, and it was not at all clear how they would fall and what the world would look like afterwards. At this stage, as a dominion, Canada's fortunes and in large part foreign policy is intertwined with the soon-to-be-sunsetting British Empire. The success and contributions of Canadian forces during the war led to a considerable and growing sense of national confidence and pride, and stirrings of questions about their future role in the imperial scheme of things. Then Prime Minister Mackenzie King was among the first to use the word Commonwealth to characterize a future looser political configuration, which would largely come to pass in just a few decades. Canadians then begin to ponder possible future national threats. The Anglo-American alliance that won the war seemed solid enough, except a World War I treaty between Britain and Japan required British aid and support should Japan find itself at war with somebody else, say the Americans, which wasn't out of the question. And you know, the Americans are right there. And maybe it's not impossible that they might get frisky again? Enter Colonel James Sutherland Buster Brown, described as an ardent imperialist and looking for all the world like a minor character in a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta. A man of principle and sense of justice, strong-willed, somewhat naive, forthright, highly respected by his men and peers, with something of an anti-American streak and not particularly politically savvy, as his son portrays him in a biography. Just the kind of guy who would come up with an idea like this and push for its adoption no matter what. As director of military operations and intelligence, a one-person operation, his role is to survey, assess, and plan for a range of external threats to Canada. He is seized with the notion that the greatest risk was an armed American invasion, and thus some sort of counter-strategy was necessary. Thus we get defense scheme number one. First of all, that's defense with a C. Canadian English largely preserves spellings from British English because, well, they didn't have a revolution or a Noah Webster. And secondly, there were other schemes, 2, 3, 4, to deal with threats from Japan, Europe, and elsewhere, though what fun are those? In a nutshell, Brown envisioned 5 separate prongs of forces, flying columns of soldiers, moving into the U.S. from Canada at the first sign of American hostilities, attacking across the border from Maine to reclaim it, across to Albany, Niagara Falls, Detroit and the Great Lakes, Minneapolis, Fargo, Great Falls, Spokane, Portland, and here in Seattle. Pro tip for any future invaders heading our way. Interstate 5 is fine coming south, though it does tend to clog up around the outlet mall. But there is a Costco in Shoreline if you need to stock up. As Canada was outnumbered 10 to 1, the plan's objective was not to occupy, instead rather to surprise and shock, to destroy infrastructure such as roads, trains, bridges, and then withdraw back home, leading American forces unable to pursue, and then waiting for the British to come to their aid, boosting home morale, demoralizing Americans. None of which was ever going to happen, largely because he never consulted with the Brits or much of anybody else, including in his own government, insisting instead that it be kept as secret as possible, which would have made implementation something of an issue as well. His planning involved what can only be called bargain basement espionage missions, consisting largely of Brown and a few staff driving around northern New York State in civilian clothes to observe the locals, getting free maps from gas stations, taking pictures. In later years, trips to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and Vermont, where he finds the men fat and lazy but pleasant and congenial, and the women heavy and comely, were used to help update the plan. Technically, this scheme was officially in place from 1921 to 1931, when a quietly appalled new commanding officer ordered all copies burned. Happily, at least one survived and is now in the collection of Queen's University in Ontario, all 200 quixotic pages of it. There were, indeed, supporters among the military hierarchy, many of whom were enthralled by the panache of it all, and who even proposed taking trips on field trips of potential targets for reconnaissance. To be fair, Brown wasn't entirely off base. The 1930 U.S. War Plan Red, one of several such colorful efforts, was in effect a mirror image, laying out an American invasion and seizure of Canada, from Vancouver to the prairies, Winnipeg, the heart of Ontario, Toronto, and the port of Halifax, while troops from Vermont would take Montreal and Quebec, no doubt in retaliation for Brown's snotty comments. This was all intended to preempt a British invasion, oust them, and create the United States of North America. That plan was updated in 1935, war games were held to rehearse it, and good old reliable crypto-Nazi Charles Lindbergh suggested the use of chemical weapons for good measure. Most of the accounts I read about this, apart from a couple of serious military histories which deem it suicidal, have a bemused tone, employing words like daffy, zany, madcap, more associated with a Marx Brothers movie than a war plan. It feels a little like a game of Risk. Okay, I'm going to invade the eastern United States from Ontario and then Kamchatka from Alaska. Roll the dice. But talking about invasion and attacks and war is always serious, no matter how fanciful or hilarious it might seem. Once you have a war plan or a weapon, however boneheaded, there's always a temptation. It's there to be used, so... We haven't often thought of Canada and the U.S. eyeing each other suspiciously, other than over Olympic hockey games. That's the sort of thing that happens somewhere else, in somebody else's backyard. I guess even the best of neighbors can get riled up if sufficiently provoked. The image of war, real war, being fought in Montana or Maine or British Columbia or Nova Scotia is at once laughable and sobering, no matter how it might start. Maybe it's best to give the South Park guys the last words with the last few lines of Blame Canada as sung by Robin Williams on the Oscars broadcast. The smut we must cut, the trash we must bash, the laughter and fun must all be undone. We must blame them and cause a fuss before somebody thinks of blaming us.